This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Invasive species outbreaks often adhere to a common scenario, sort of like the plot of a real-life scary movie playing out in slow motion. One of northern Utah's well-known invasive species recently reminded The Source's Ross Chambliss of a scary movie from his childhood.
Well, go ahead, mister. Look around. See if there's something you like.
So I watched this horror movie again recently. If you're a child of the 80s like I am, then you probably know it. It's the 1984 Steven Spielberg film, Gremlins. It starts off with Rand Peltzer, a struggling inventor played by Hoyt Axton, who visits a Chinatown antique shop looking for a Christmas present for his son, Billy.
Are these things real?
I told you, everything's real.
There, Peltzer finds this cute, furry little creature called a mogwai.
What is it?
Mogwai.
What's he doing?
Singing. He does that sometimes.
Peltzer wants to buy it, but the elder Chinese owner with a long white beard refuses.
Father? With mogwai comes much responsibility. I cannot sell him at any price.
But Peltzer, of course, ends up buying the mogwai anyway from the old man's grandson in secret behind the store. And he takes it home, but not before receiving some words of warning.
Keep him out of the light. He hates bright light, especially sunlight. It'll kill him. And keep him away from water. Don't get him wet. But the most important rule, the rule you can never forget, no matter how much he cries, no matter how much he begs, never, never feed him after midnight. You got it?
Sure, kid, whatever you say.
The reason I bring this up is that Gremlins, it seems to me, can be understood as a parable about invasive species. It goes like this. A foreign critter is moved to a new place. This critter could be a plant, an insect, a fish, or whatever. The foreign critter is relocated either by accident or sometimes on purpose by a person, maybe because this critter is cute or special or useful in some way. But inevitably, in the end, all hell breaks loose. And the rest of the story becomes an exercise in killing it, or at least containing it. Now, it needs to be said that, in truth, most non-native or introduced critters do not become some predatorial scourge. In fact, many relocated species die off in their new homes. Some might barely eke out an existence. Most do not suddenly swell into some swarming mass of monsters, but some do.
I'm Karin Kettenring.
Karin is an associate professor of wetland ecology at Utah State University.
And I study wetland ecology, particularly focusing on wetland plants, wetland restoration, and invasive species in wetlands.
Karin is concerned about a particular invasive species here in Utah.
The species is called Phragmites australis. One of the common names is common reed, but the interesting thing about Phragmites is that people actually use the Latin name, Phragmites, which is the genus, to refer to it.
She says this plant first appeared on the east coast of North America over 150 years ago.
The general consensus seems to be, at least in terms of how it got from Eurasia, which is where it originated, to the Atlantic coast, is that it was used as packing material. So it has these really big, fluffy seed heads, which before the age of styrofoam and peanuts would have been the perfect packing material. And so if people are packing boxes, crates with these Phragmites seeds, and then they show up in a new environment and it can survive in that new environment, then it'll take hold and can spread from there.
Gee, Billy, where can I get one of those?
I don't know. This is the only one I've ever seen.
The mogwai, or gizmo, certainly seemed to adapt well to his new environment. That is, until he got wet.
Thanks a lot. Sorry.
What was in that jar?
Nothing, just water.
It turns out getting the mogwai wet causes him to multiply and regenerate more mogwai. Water is key to this reproduction, just as it is for Phragmites. Karin says what's interesting about Phragmites is that for over a century, almost 120 years, it just kind of sat there, biding its time on the Atlantic coast before it somehow spread westward.
And more recently, people have been able to kind of piece together what happened. So it was on the Atlantic coast, it wasn't doing a whole lot, But what we think has happened is that we've essentially primed our environment to be the perfect conditions for it. It really does well in high nutrient conditions. And so, for instance, on the Atlantic coast, as more suburban development is happening along shorelines, is the more fertilizer running off of lawns and ending up, for instance, in the Chesapeake Bay and some of the rivers that feed the bay. And so those really nutrient-rich conditions, Phragmites really thrives in. And so as we've seen a lot of development, we saw the cover of Phragmites really increasing a lot. And we think that's also what happened out here in Utah. So it got out here, and our environment is actually a really perfect environment for this species. So it can do well in a wide range of salinity conditions. And it does well particularly in nutrient-rich areas. So, for instance, Farmington Bay, there's a lot of Phragmites there. It's also, there are a lot of nutrient issues.
The outbreak came to Utah around the mid to late 1980s, after the Great Salt Lake had flooded its shoreline for several years.
Basically, much of the Great Salt Lake wetlands were left as this barren landscape, and that was actually the perfect environment for Phragmites to take off. It likes lots of bare, moist, open places with no competition.
Since the early 90s, the plant has exploded, taking over much of northern Utah.
When I try to describe to people where it is, it's basically between about Bear Lake down to Utah Lake and everything in between. There certainly is invasive Phragmites south of Utah Lake, but it's much less dominant. So on the Great Salt Lake in particular, we have more than 25,000 acres of it. And all the along highways, in roadside ditches, you'll see it if you're driving up and down I-15. In Cache Valley, we have it in Cutler Reservoir. We actually have it now in the town of Logan in this one little landslide area. So it's just starting to pop up in other places, even outside of wetlands and roadside ditches.
Like the Phragmites, the gremlins wasted no time in exploiting ways to multiply. One finds a swimming pool at the YMCA. This causes more and more gremlin clones to spring to life. But as for Phragmites, well, they've managed to spread quickly in different ways.
It has these two main ways to spread, which is first by seeds, but it can also spread asexually, so by basically sending out stems below ground or stems above ground. Those are called rhizomes and runners or stolons. We had this assumption that it was spreading mostly by rhizomes and stolons, but then we also saw that it was spreading really, really rapidly across a huge area, and that really can only occur by seeds. And so we did some genetic work actually to try to figure out how much of the reproduction is seeds versus this asexual reproduction, and it turned out that it actually was mostly by seeds.
As it turns out, this Phragmites outbreak has not been good for the ecosystems of northern Utah waterways and the Great Salt Lake, just as the gremlin outbreak was not beneficial for the ecosystem of Kingston Falls. There, an army of gremlins rampage through the town and attack its citizens. They attack Billy's mother. She gets away, but not before shredding one in her blender and exploding one in her microwave. I know, gross. The gremlins then kill poor Mrs. Deagle, who's in a wheelchair, by launching her through a window. They nearly kill Billy's neighbors, too, the Futtermans, by driving a snowplow through their house. They even take over Dory's tavern and harass Billy's girlfriend, Kate. If we're comparing the Phragmites, from a wildlife perspective, they've been doing similar things.
So we're not talking about something that's 2 feet tall. This plant can grow 15 to 20 feet tall. So it's literally towering over you. It's also so incredibly dense that it's nearly impossible to move through. So the stems are so dense, it's something like people might be familiar with bamboo, and kind of when you have a really dense patch of bamboo in somebody's yard. Part of the reason why it's such a problem is because it's so tall and so dense, and also it's a perennial plant, which means that it grows back year after year from the same root system. And what is left each year is lots and lots of dead plant material from the previous year. And so in some places you'll have 3 feet or 4 feet of dead plant material essentially just accumulating over time. So nothing can grow through that environment. There's no light. It's pretty insulated. So the ground will stay frozen longer in the spring. And so any of the normal vegetation that we value for habitat for wildlife, that vegetation basically can't persist in it. Hmm. It's also not good habitat for most wildlife species.
There are exceptions, she says. Songbirds seem to do well, along with some of the more secretive marsh birds. Additionally, biologists say Phragmites might help with sequestering heavy metals in the wetlands that are harmful to people and wildlife. And this raises a good point. Invasive biologists, yes, there is such a discipline, say sometimes foreign species aren't always bad. Sometimes non-native species can play a positive role for ecosystems, and removing them once they're established could even have unintended consequences. Still, for Billy and the citizens of Kingston Falls, the solution to the gremlin invasion is clear. The rest of the story becomes a strategy of slaughter, finding the best, most efficient means for killing off the critters to contain the outbreak. Billy discovers all the gremlins in a movie theater watching Snow White. He manages to explode the theater, and they all burn to death. Well, nearly all of them. They did have to make a Gremlins 2, after all. Some might say the battle to rid Utah's waterways of Phragmites has been a struggle of equal proportions, if not more.
If we had our druthers and there were not air quality issues, we would probably spray for 3 years with herbicide and then go through and burn each year to clear out the dead plant material. So burning is a really effective way to get rid of it. There are huge air quality problems, though, and obviously we cannot be compromising human health for the Phragmites treatments.
Okay, so burning, bad idea.
Another thing that people are using is grazing. So there's actually people are using cattle grazing out in some of these wetlands on the Great Salt Lake. And so the cattle will actually eat fresh Phragmites, and through the herd movement through the Phragmites, they'll kind of pack down some of the old Phragmites that's still persisting there. There also are some concerns, as you might imagine, of having cows in wetlands and them excreting into wetlands and nutrient issues that are already a problem.
Others have found that mowing and spraying the Phragmites with herbicide can do the trick. You have to kill it at its roots or it'll just grow back. Recently, one of the land managers on the Great Salt Lake, the Nature Conservancy, brought a state-of-the-art machine into the frag fight.
I've been spraying frag since 1996, and sometimes I feel like I'm going in a circle, but we gotta try, so.
This is Chris Brown. He's the director of stewardship for the Nature Conservancy. He drives what I can only describe as a floating tank. It's called a Marshmaster, brought up from the bayous of Louisiana, a glorified lawnmower with an herbicide-spraying gun turret on the back. It costs over $160,000.
It's a funny plant. Sometimes you'll spray an area and it'll just die out and it's gone. And then sometimes you'll spray it out and it looks like it's dead, and then 2 years later it comes back. It's just really hard to understand why it does certain things at certain sites, and why sometimes you spray it and it's gone, and sometimes you spray it and 3 years later you're back to square one again.
Brown says they used to use a tractor out here.
But we used to get stuck all the time, and we'd spend 2 days trying to get us unstuck, and we'd have to bring in track hose, and it was a big mess for a long time. But now, with this, we'll be able to get around. We won't have to worry about getting stuck. If we get this stuck, we're in real trouble. And so this will be one way of doing it. We will do some small treatments in other areas that are off an ATV or off the tractor. And then we have usually a helicopter or an airplane that will come in for the big stands. I mean, even with this, it would take us, you know, forever to sit and spray 200 acres of frag, where I can have a plane come in and spray 200 acres in about, you know, 5 hours, which would take me 2 weeks probably, even with this. So yeah, we use everything we can. Like I said, this, the cows, the airplane, the helicopter, whatever.
Karen Kettenring says her graduate students have been experimenting on Phragmites since 2012, testing how it responds to different types of herbicide and when to apply it.
And the goal really is not just to kill the Phragmites, but actually to restore the habitat, to restore the native species that people care about for wildlife. And for the first 3 years, basically none of those species were coming back. We were getting pretty good at killing Phragmites and not restoring that habitat. Just now in the fourth year of the study, we're starting to see some native vegetation coming back, but it's still looking pretty bleak even 4 years after we've started these treatments, and these are representative of what managers would normally be doing, kind of their normal three-year sequence of spraying herbicide and then letting everything recover.
There's not much that's positive to report here, sorry to say. If anything, Phragmites has taught us a lot about dealing with invasive species.
Yeah, I would say in the case of Phragmites and many other species, it's about focusing on how to contain those new pockets that show up. And so in some places, we may have lost the battle if we have 20,000 acres of solid Phragmites, but in other places, landowners might just have a quarter acre of Phragmites or, you know, a couple mussels that have shown up or something like that. And so trying to target those new arrivals and those new invasions before they get out of hand.
Right. Snuff them out early.
Exactly. And that's kind of a broad recommendations that people make across invasive species. You have to take care of those small populations. It's a lot more satisfying to look at the massive stand of Phragmites or massive invasion of a frog in some place and want to just really make a big impact and try to get rid of them. But in a lot of cases, they've been kind of pushed. Those populations are stable and we're not going to be able to actually deal with them. So be strategic about what you're doing.
So there you have it. Be strategic. Be smart. And remember, if your dad brings home a bundle of exotic Phragmites australis for you in a pot, please don't give it water. Don't give it sunlight. And for goodness sakes, don't feed it after midnight. For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
After a short break, only you can prevent spreading the STD of the sea. Also, learn which non-native Utah fish taste like lobster. Stay tuned. When the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources encouraged people this summer to practice safe boating, they weren't talking about wearing your life vest. They meant taking steps to avoid getting an STD.
Always practice safe boating. Don't infect Utah's lakes and streams with a skiff-transmitted disease. Invasive mussels start out as microscopic villagers.
The STD implicated in these ads is actually a family of freshwater mussels, zebra and quagga mussels, that have found their way into Utah's lakes where they reproduce rapidly and cause a lot of problems.
They had one of their biologists come and meet with us and give us a lot of history on the issue, you know, where the quagga and zebra mussels came from and how they've been moving their way across the United States and moving west.
That's Christina Davis, an account manager at Penna Powers, an advertising firm in Salt Lake City. The Utah Division of Wildlife Resources asked her for help communicating the problem of invasive mussels in Utah.
They really let us know that the mussels, these invasive mussels destroy fisheries, they pollute shorelines and recreation areas, they damage boats and equipment, and ultimately cost the state millions of dollars to control.
Kenny Hammond is a senior art director at Penna Powers. In what may have been the most hilarious, irreverent, and pun-filled creative meeting for a DWR public service announcement, Hammond and his team came up with the STD of the Sea campaign, comparing invasive quagga and zebra mussels to sexually transmitted diseases passed from lake to lake by careless boaters not using proper protection.
We knew that anglers and people that were involved with wildlife were probably already educated on that. So we knew we needed to talk to more of the casual type boater, the people that are out there water skiing and wakeboarding. And, you know, they're out there to enjoy themselves and on a weekend to get away from it all. So we needed a message that didn't come forth so authoritative, that is a little more fun for them, and that would get them to stop and listen and maybe take a look at a flyer a second time, maybe even get a laugh.
One of the things that the Division of Wildlife told us when we first met with them is that they've been out and educating people about this for years, but boaters have been seeing the same signs and the same pictures and the same words for years now, and they had kind of just become deaf to it. They were just ignoring it. So coming at it from a new, fresh angle was something that was really important.
In the video for the campaign, there are some odd choices of lakes to include on the map. In addition to Utah Lake and Lake Powell, there's Amy Lake, Ashley Lake, Allen Lake, and Matt Warner Reservoir. These are not the most famous bodies of water in Utah. Hammond says that the personal names of some of Utah's lakes actually clued them into the STD idea. Like, you wouldn't want Allen to spread quagga mussels to Ashley. But seriously, there's an intimacy to water that's part of what works about the campaign, cheeky as it may be.
That's what we were trying to at least convey, is that you gotta, if you love these bodies of water and you love boating and you love water skiing and all these things, then you should take care to clean your boat.
Obviously, the Division of Wildlife Resources liked the idea because they ran the campaign all summer. But I asked Hammond how it went over when he first presented the idea to the division.
In my experience with client meetings, it was one of the best client meetings I've ever had. I think they felt like we had delivered on exactly what they had asked for, because they had asked for something that would break through the clutter, something that would get people to start listening. And I think this campaign delivered on exactly the points and the goals that they wanted to accomplish.
So is it working?
You know, most of what we've had is really kind of anecdotal feedback and evidence. We haven't had the opportunity to go out and do a survey or anything like that to measure the results. But what we're hearing anecdotally is just that is that people are remembering it. It's standing out to them, and that they're remembering it. When the news media covers the invasive mussels problem in Utah, we hear them saying STD of the sea. And so that's kind of stuck with them, too. It's kind of, again, it's kind of a funny thing to be able to say. And so as far as that goes, we're looking at that as being a success.
I know sometimes, just to get people to listen, sometimes you have to be a little irreverent and kind of push the boundaries to get people to listen. And we knew that this was an important issue, and we needed to get people to pay closer attention to it.
Well, congratulations, and thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
That was Christina Davis and Kenny Hammond from the Office of PENA Powers in Salt Lake City, the brain children behind the STD of the Sea campaign to raise awareness about invasive freshwater mussels in Utah. It's extremely difficult to clean up an infected body of water once it's been infected by these mussels, so the Division of Wildlife Resources is focused on preventing their spread to uninfected lakes. The message is pretty simple. Clean all the mud and lake gunk off your boat when you pull it out of the water. Drain everything that can be holding water on your boat, like ballast tanks or bilges. And then let your boat completely dry out before putting it back in the water. Right now, the infestation is limited to Lake Powell in Utah, and hopefully the STD of the Sea campaign can scare boaters into keeping the rest of the state clean.
Together, we can stop the spread of invasive mussels.
For The Source, I'm Jennifer Pemberton. The Colorado River has a lot of fish in it, but not all are native and not all are nice. Chrissy Wilson is the Native Aquatic Species Program Coordinator at the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. She oversees a statewide program for native fish, amphibians, reptiles, and mollusks. Ross Chambliss spoke with her about the good, the bad, and the ugly of the Colorado River's fish and what's being done to protect the natives.
Can you describe the Upper Colorado River Endangered Fish Recovery Program? What is that? What is its purpose?
So there are four fish that have been listed endangered in the Green and Colorado, which comprises the Upper Colorado River Basin. Those four species are razorback sucker, Colorado pike minnow, bony tail, and humpback chub. Those four species have been listed endangered for some of them 20 plus years, and we've been working towards recovery of those four species within that Upper Colorado system. The Upper Colorado River Program was put together to facilitate enhancement, protection, conservation, water use for water users, so we still allow people to develop water while we try to recover these four endangered fishes. The thing that's very unique about this program is that it's used as a program nationwide for folks to look at as a successful program. And the reason being is that if you're familiar with when someone files a water application and they want to obtain water to use for irrigation, many times they are sued. There's a lot of lawsuits that are involved whenever anybody wants to take water from somewhere. Well, this program was set up specifically to allow recovery, but still allow water development. So in the last 15, 20 years that this program has been in place, we've had something along the lines of several thousand water applications that have been approved. Their mitigation is the program. So it's very unique in that way that we still are allowing water development, but we are working together to recover the species. So it's very unique in that aspect.
I see. The next question is really, why are these fish endangered? And I understand part of the answer perhaps comes from how the river's environment has changed since the beginning of the last century.
Right. If you think about the dams that have been put on, you know, the Flaming Gorge Dam, these fish are what we call big river fishes. The Colorado pike minnow is known to migrate hundreds of miles. So if you think about the Colorado River system, it used to be 500-700 miles from the headwaters all the way to Mexico is where the Colorado River system used to run. So these fish, specifically the Colorado pike minnow, they used to migrate 400-500 miles. That was not an unusual migration pattern for these large river fish. These are big fish. Colorado pike minnow, historically, we have records of up to 7 feet. They are the largest minnow in North America. They are amazing, amazing animals. So these are fish that have evolved in a real big river system. And so they migrate long courses. They deal with high variability. If you think about in the summertime, the flows are probably pretty low, but we have up to 20,000, 30,000 CFS, which is a huge big river system. So these animals have adapted to this variable desert environment, and they've been there for thousands and thousands of years. And they are truly amazing, amazing fish.
Wow. But with the sort of the installation of dams, removal of water for irrigation and other things, introduction of non-native fish, these fish have become at risk.
Right. The biggest threat that we face with right now with recovery of these fishes is invasive species. And these are, there are probably right now 32 non-native fish that are found in the Colorado and the Green Rivers. And these are all fish that came from somewhere else. That we introduced them as sport fish. We introduced them as bait fish. There's just been a lot of different reasons they've been introduced.
Right.
And these fish are very naive. They don't know how to compete with many of these species.
I was reading, actually, that many of the fish species were actually introduced between the 1930s and 50s by state and federal agencies, actually.
Exactly. Back then, we didn't really know. We were just trying to provide a service to our public that wanted to be able to fish. And in many cases, the native fishes have been fished out. So if you think about cutthroats, you know, if you know very much about Utah Lake used to be the home of the Bonneville cutthroat trout. Well, the early settlers totally exploited that fishery, and so the cutthroat was totally removed from the Utah Lake. So then we started, as a state agency, trying to provide a service for our public to provide fishing. We started introducing these fish to provide fish for subsistence, you know, especially 50 years ago. People that went fishing, they kept them. They ate them. That was part of subsistence, of their survival for them. So we didn't know better back then, but we do know better now.
And I guess it's sort of ironic, though, that some of the same agencies involved with introducing these fish way back then are now, decades later, working to get rid of them.
This is what the Division of Wildlife Resources, the stand that we're looking at now is that we want to protect and recover native fishes. But we also still want to provide the service that the angling public wants. They still want these fish. They still want the walleye, and they want the smallmouth bass. They want those species. So what we as a division are looking at is that there are places for those fish, and most of those are in reservoirs. They're artificial systems where we have smallmouth bass and we can have walleye. But in the river where we're trying to recover the fish, that's where we're doing the non-native removal. We're trying to remove all those predaceous non-native fish that prevent us from recovering these species.
I see. Now, so I understand that there are actually quite a few non-native fish species in the Colorado River system, but it's true that not all of them are necessarily harmful or considered predatorial to the natives.
True. Remember I said that there was like 32 non-native species? There's only four that we are really targeting, and that's burbot that was illegally introduced into Flaming Gorge. We are hoping that it does not get into the Green River. That's a real big concern of ours. Northern pike was has escaped from a reservoir in Colorado, made its way into Utah. It's highly predatory, piscivorous fish. So it's a major predator on all of our native species, smallmouth bass and walleye. Walleye, and these smallmouth bass and walleye, they've been escaping from reservoirs. They get into the system, and their populations just explode. They flourish in these warm, desert, big river systems. So what our goal is remove the non-natives within the river system so that we can allow the natives to flourish and to increase, so hopefully we can get to the point where we downlist these species, but still have those species in the reservoirs for the anglers. So some of the steps that we're taking within the division is we are looking at creating triploid fish, sterile fish. And so a lot of what we're doing looking forward is creating sterile smallmouth bass, sterile walleye, so that we can put them in a reservoir. If they escape, it's just a very local impact. It's not that they get into the river, then they can reproduce, and then you have this exploding persistent population. So those are two of the things we're looking at is, one, sterile fish using triploid fish, and two is putting barriers below these reservoirs so that if the fish do escape, they don't get into the river system where they then can cause impact to the native species.
And maybe can you describe how exactly do they escape from the reservoirs?
Well, there's several ways. Most of the reservoirs have a outflow that's down low in the reservoir, and that's what provides water to the river for irrigation. That some fish do escape from there. That's a very low percentage because generally that's 80 to 120 feet deep. So most of our fish species are not down that deep within the reservoir, but we have documented that they do escape from there. The biggest way that they can escape is over the spillway. Many of our reservoirs, they fill them up to the top and then they allow them to spill. Well, those fish go right over the top of the reservoir, down the spillway into the river. There's a third way. We do have anglers that move fish. We've documented that in many cases of anglers that have moved fish from a reservoir, moved them where they want them to be, and many times that's within the river.
Interesting.
And also, I probably should mention that the state of Utah, we implemented what we call a must kill. And those four species that I mentioned, that if you catch those fish within the Green, the Colorado, and many of the tributaries, if you catch one of those four fish, you have to take it. You have to kill it, because we are sending a message that these fish do not belong in the river system. They belong in the reservoirs where angling public can enjoy them, but they do not belong in the river system where we're trying to recover these species. So the other fish, many of them are small-bodied. They do prey upon larvae, but it seems like they seem to be more compatible with recovery. So we're not pushing that all of these non-natives are taken out, just those that seem to have the highest predatory impact.
So I guess another question, how do a lot of these fish taste?
They're delicious.
Yeah?
From what I understand, Burbot, they call it the lobster, freshwater lobster.
Huh.
So, and the reason why they are so sought after is because they are great tasting. The angling public loves to fish for these fish.
Interesting. This is really more of a question about the native fish that we have that we're trying to preserve. And perhaps this is a question you get sometimes, but why is it so important to preserve our native fish? Why should people care?
You know, I look at it as, I'm from Utah. I was born and raised in Utah, and I'm very proud of Utah, and I love Utah. And I look at it as, these are amazing fish that have been here for thousands and thousands of years, and they're very unique in their life history, their biology, and they're big fish. They are big, cool, beautiful, beautiful fish. I should have brought you some pictures, but they are really cool fish. I look at it as, that's part of my heritage. I think that is great that we can say, these are the fish that were here thousands and thousands of years ago, long before man ever arrived. These fish have been here. I want them to be here for my grandkids. I think we can still have both. We can still have fish for the angling public and still preserve our native species, so that those folks that care about native species, they can go, they can see those native fish, and that we allow their persistence into the future.
Yeah, well, wish you the best of luck, and it'd be interesting to see in the next few years, hopefully these efforts will pay off.
Thank you.
Again, that was Chrissy Wilson. She's the Native Aquatic Species Program Coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources.
You're listening to the Invasive Species episode of The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. In May, I was on a canoe trip down the Green River through Labyrinth Canyon. A late start and a headwind on our second day meant that we were still looking for a place to camp well into late afternoon. On the map, there were all these great beaches marked, but from the water, we were staring at an impenetrable wall of vegetation on both sides. There was literally no place to land. If you pulled over, you couldn't get out of your canoe if you wanted to. We wanted to. It started to get dark. The lead boat gave the command. Pull over. Grab a Tammy. The plan was to send a scout ashore to find a landing spot for all 11 of our boats. In the meantime, we did what we were told. We paddled to the side of the river and grabbed onto a feathery branch of a tammy, a tamarisk bush. We sat there for nearly an hour, holding on to the bushes so that we wouldn't be swept downstream in the dark. The tamarisk was so thick we couldn't even get a rope through the tangle to tie off. Eventually, the scout found a slot, a hole through the vegetation wide enough for us to get off the river one canoe at a time. The exit was no wider than a footpath, but it led to a clearing large enough for all our tents against a canyon wall. We built a fire, and a flock of Canada geese flew by after midnight, which made us feel better. At least we weren't the only ones making camp late that night. Tamarisk, or salt cedar, is a bushy plant native to Eurasia. It's a well-adapted desert plant that produces deep roots and flourishes along the riverbanks in the American West. It's not native to Utah. It's invasive. It drinks a lot of water and secretes salts onto the surrounding soils, making it very difficult for its neighbors to survive. In places like that stretch of the Green River where I was canoeing earlier this year, tamarisk has choked out a lot of the native species and has happily formed a wall along its riverfront property. Later in the summer, I was rafting on another stretch of the Green River through Dinosaur National Monument. This is upstream from Labyrinth Canyon by about 200 miles. At a place called Echo Park, just downstream from where the Yampa River makes a dramatic entrance into the flow of the Green, there's a huge bank of dead tamarisk. The river has cut the bank a bit, and you can see their massive tangle of deep roots. It's like an iceberg. 90% of this plant seems to be below the surface. I asked way too many questions of my river guide. Finally, she said, "You need to talk to the park botanist. She knows everything about invasive species management here. Her name is Tamara. No joke. That should be easy to remember." I looked up Tamara Tamarisk of Dinosaur National Monument when I got home. Literally, that's what I Googled because I couldn't remember her last name.
My name is Tamara Nauman. I am an ecologist with the National Park Service at Dinosaur National Monument.
How long have you been in that position?
Almost 21 years.
Let's see, what year would that have been when you showed up at Dinosaur?
1995.
What did the River Corridor look like when you showed up?
Well, you recently had an opportunity to take a float trip through the park, so it looked very much like what you see now. It's beautiful river canyons interspersed with open floodplain areas that locally are called parks. On the Green River in particular, which is now regulated since 1963 with Flaming Gorge Dam, there's a lot more vegetation on the banks than there would have been prior to regulation. When I arrived here, I noticed right away there were a lot of non-native plant species, but also a lot of healthy native vegetation. Dinosaur is has an interesting history. It started as an 80-acre national monument in 1915, specifically to protect the dinosaur fossils around the quarry visitor center area. In 1938, however, it was expanded to nearly its current size to include the canyons of the Green and Yampa Rivers. So a lot of my time gets spent on things related to the river and pretty much everything related to river ecosystem health and function is in my folder.
Your job sounds huge. But you've also, I think, figured out a way to use some volunteer labor to help you out. Why aren't there five of you in that park? Can you talk about the Weed Warriors program a little bit?
When I arrived in Dinosaur, I met with the superintendent and my supervisor on my first day, and they said, "Hi, welcome. We're glad you're here. Here's the list of things we want you to work on," and invasive weeds was right at the top of the list. And I said, "Great, what's my budget?" And they said, "Well, here are the keys to your truck and your office, and we got you some furniture and a computer." And I said, "Great, what's my budget?" And they said, "Well, here's the thing." And after some more pressing, I learned that my operating budget for an entire year was about $500. Okay. I know you said weeds was the number one priority, but I can't do anything about the weed problem here on $500 a year. So I think what I will be doing as my number one priority is figuring out how to build some capacity here, including getting money. So I would say for the first 7 or 8 years that I was here, every single thing I did was calculated to get either attention or money, because you can't really get money without getting attention first. And volunteers just seemed like an obvious way to go, because this is such a beautiful place, as you recently discovered, that it's easy to attract volunteers to work hard. And managing weeds in a remote and very rugged river canyon system is both logistically challenging and very hard work. It essentially amounts to digging holes and sawing branches and hauling branches around in 100-degree heat, or possibly rain, or sometimes snow. And so it's tough work, but it's very easy to find people who are interested in helping. In this kind of business, if you take pictures of smiling people working hard in a beautiful environment and put them in a grant proposal, you can pretty much get money. So we got a lot of grants in the early years just to try to get something up and running. And fortunately, we attracted enough attention with all that work over the years that now I have a well-supported program.
Is the Weed Warriors program like seasonal? Do you have a certain number of volunteers for per year, or have you had some volunteers that have been there the whole time? How does it work?
Well, through about 2010, we had several hundred volunteers a year helping us out. And at that point, I realized we were pretty much had met or were about to meet all of the goals we had set for ourselves for removing tamarisk and a couple of other species from the river corridor. And so since that time, I've dialed back on the Weed Warrior Volunteer Program. And now I just work with a few people every year on that, and I'm spending more of my time these days working to develop long-term science and ecological monitoring program for the river systems in Dinosaur. I'm just a couple years out from retirement, so I thought, well, okay, we accomplished way more than I thought we could when we started with the tamarisk and other weed removal in the river corridor. So there are other things the park needs, and so I'm spending more time in that area for the last few years of my career here.
Wow, that's so great. I mean, that feels good at the end of a career, doesn't it? You accomplished so much.
Well, it's a great park, and it's very easy to come to work every day. It's a privilege to work in such a beautiful place. There's a lot of things that need to be done here, though, so at times it's a little bit overwhelming, but if you stick around, I guess, as long as I have, eventually you can start to see the results of the effort. And certainly, I think at this point we're over 6,500 volunteers who have helped us with all of this stuff over the years. So lots of people care about their national parks, and Dinosaur is a place where that the results of that love are very obvious.
How do you spread that love to other parts of the river that are not in Dinosaur? Because the park, people do love their parks and they do love the river. But I've floated some stretches of the river that aren't in the park, and they don't look quite as good. Is there any way that you can, or does anything in your kind of future plan extend outside of the park?
That's certainly something that I think about often, and I also worry about. And I will say that on occasion I have found ways to stretch outside of our boundaries to try to do things that will help the river in a broader sense. Some of the science work that we've encouraged here in the park with partners like Utah State University and Colorado State University and other agencies is now spreading to other park units in the Colorado River system. So just communicating with colleagues is one way of, I'll say, improving influence around, at least in the downstream direction. Certainly after I retire, I will find a way to contribute outside the boundaries of the park in some way, because the rivers are in my heart, and I'm not going to just walk out the door on them.
One sort of great thing about your work, I mean, you have that audience of private boaters and commercial boaters, I mean, who are coming down the river and seeing what you're doing, and it's already a group of kind of curious people who are interested in nature. And so I think as far as getting attention, you know, anytime I see somebody working on a stream bank or in a boat, especially in a Park Service boat, I'm always asking, you know, what are you guys doing? What are you working on? So I think that's one sort of kind of special inadvertent way of advertising the work that you guys are doing.
That's true. And I will say over the years that the amount of support we've gotten from the boating community has just been tremendous. They float by with questions or sometimes just thank yous, and it always makes the volunteers really happy. It's just one of those sort of obvious expressions of why Americans like their national parks so much.
Well, thanks so much for your work, and thanks for taking the time.
Well, I hope you get a chance to come to Dinosaur more often.
I've got nothing to worry about.
That was Tamara Nauman, botanist at Dinosaur National Monument. In 2012, she was honored with the Superior Service Award from the Department of the Interior, in part for her innovative and tenacious efforts to control non-native species in the park. Thanks for letting The Source invade your airwaves today. The program originates from the studios of Utah Public Radio on the campus of Utah State University in Logan. It's produced by me, Jennifer Pemberton, and Ryan Cunningham. Ross Chambliss is our contributing reporter extraordinaire. Major support comes from iUtah. There are 8 other episodes of The Source for you to catch up on. They're all available at upr.org. We'll be back next month with more stories about Utah water, some creepier than others. Until then, thank you for listening.
Close my eyes.